Steve Ryaltz, and I'm here with attorney Eric Berg. Yes, we can hear and see all three of you. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Can you also both see the clock in gallery mode? It should be on your screen.
Yes.
It's tiny, but yes.
All right. I think it turns red when you run out of time. So what I'm going to do now is I am going to call the next case. This is the second of our three cases on our Zoom oral argument calendar today. This is A231949. Charlie and Mr. Ferguson, can you help me pronounce your client's last name?
Yes, Tomke, Your Honor.
Charlie Tomke, appellant versus Christopher Ronald Lamke, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Lamke, yes.
Respondent. And let me introduce myself again for the recording. My name is Kayla Eid. I'm the presiding judge today. I'm joined by Judge Jennifer Frisch and Judge Sarah Wheelock. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and both parties will have 15 minutes for their principal argument. Mr. Ferguson, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please make sure that you state your appearance for the record when you begin your argument. And there'll be a recording available this afternoon or tomorrow. That's the only recording that's supposed to be made of this proceeding. Failure to comply with that rule could result in sanction or other contempt proceeding. And with that, Mr. Ferguson, when you are ready to proceed, please go ahead.
Thank you, Justices. My name is Aaron Ferguson. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Tomke, the plaintiff in this action. The relief we are seeking is reversal of the trial court's dismissal of this matter by granting summary judgment. And I would like to begin by saying thank you for graciously hearing this. I have a bit of a problem at oral argument. I talk fast, and so I'm going to try and do what I can to slow down. I also happen to do a lot of workers' compensation work, and so I'm going to be diving into what is unfortunately a little bit of a review. So that the court can appreciate some of the issues we're contending with. I'm going to just start off by saying that we believe that modification of the Stringer holding needs to occur in this case because failure to do so would, I think,
Can we pause for 1 second? I just want to be sure that the recording is actually being made. I did check with Ms. Gergen earlier. I just don't see the red light. Okay, thank you, Ms. Gergen, and I apologize, Mr. Ferguson. Go ahead.
No, we don't want to do this twice, right? I mean, yeah. What's the fun in that, huh? So I want to start off with some basic issues here in this court. There seems to be a bit of confusion about some of the material facts. The underlying trial court didn't make a lot of findings of facts, and in particular at page 6, they really cited to a very limited number of information. We think there's a standard issue at play here because, quote, all material facts are to be held and inferences to be held in favor of the non-moving party, which would be Mr. Tomke. And I would call the court's attention to the deposition transcript of Mr. Tomke at pages 45, 46, and 47, which articulate Mr. Tomke's testimony about the events as they transpired on May 22nd, 2018. The reason why that is of critical importance is because we're really here to talk about the Workers' Compensation Act, which I know for the Court of Appeals isn't something you ordinarily do because you're not a mandatory writ of review for workers' compensation decisions. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court is, and they get to hear all of our fun. So I want to start off by identifying that the Workers' Compensation Act was promulgated back in 1913. And for the longest period of time under the Act, there was a common law notion that co-employees did not have co-extensive immunity with the employer. And that fact has remained true even all the way through the promulgation of 176061, subdivision 1, and most notably here when we're talking about subsection 5. And I would just call your attention to Justice Hansen's dissent in Stringer because he does a nice job explaining that historical analysis.
I mean, counsel, I appreciate the historical context of this case. I personally am familiar with this history, so I'm just going to cut to the chase with my question, and that is, it does seem to me that we as a reviewing court are constrained by Stringer, which does provide that when the benefits are paid, we're acting in the course and scope of employment. And the district court made a finding that I think is undisputed that the actions of the co-employee tortfeasor and your client are indivisible because they're going to the job site. So that is something that occurred in the course and scope of employment. And Stringer's been around for a while, and the legislature hasn't taken any action to unwind the holding in Stringer. So what are we to do with that? I mean, if you want us to be a placeholder so you can seek review at the court, at the Supreme Court, then I think that you should say that. But otherwise, what are we to do with this?
Great question. So let's reflect on the fact that Minnesota Statute 645.16, right? The words of the law and their application to existing situation are clear and free from ambiguity. Then the letter of the law shall not be disregarded, right? And as Justice Hansen identified in subsection E, talking about co-employee liability, its very particular phraseology has been expanded and the standards of a plaintiff such as Mr. Tomke heightened beyond that which the legislature contemplated when they passed the statute. So the starting point here.
But you're quoting from the dissent, and our case law requires us as the Court of Appeals to follow the binding precedent of the Supreme Court. And also our case law says that where the Supreme Court, or even if our court has construed the statute and the legislature hasn't taken action, that's an indication that that is the law. So I don't know how we can rule in your favor without running headlong into that. Can
great.
You help me
with that? That's great. And so I'm kind of getting about this in a roundabout way, and I'm sorry, sometimes lawyers do a bad job of that. I'm doing that. So let me just cut to the punchline. There is a distinction to be made as to whether Mr. Lamke was in the course and scope of his employment entitled to benefits under work comp. There is also a distinction about Mr. Tomke being entitled to benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act, and as to whether the act taken on May 22nd, 2018, a direct action, not a general administrative duty, but a direct action taken to Mr. Tomke, which he testified about, was at the request of Mr. Lamke. And Mr. Lamke testified that was not in the course of his duties. Mr. Lamke testified about that repeatedly. And so if we have this umbrella under Stringer, the question is, was the direct act, prong one, personal duty, taken subject to his job duties, his employment duties? And we briefed this, I think, thoroughly. And the answer is unequivocally that no one disputes that Mr. Lamke did not have that within his job duty. It wasn't anywhere in his job duties.
You are equating a job duty with a job requirement, something that is mandated by the employer. I mean, at least that's how I read your brief. What is the authority for that proposition? Because I'm not finding it in the law.
So within Stringer, the court had talked about that. So when we talk about the two preceding cases, primarily Wicken and Dolly, they talked about a global employment administrative standard, right? And then in Stringer is really the first case that we have a situation of direct action. And the Stringer court spent a lot of time talking about that direct action that the two folks took towards Corey Stringer was under the umbrella of their job duties. And they repeatedly talked about that, and we did brief this issue. And the question then is, okay, well, if that job duty is something that isn't within the job requirements, then maybe Stringer says this is the situation where co-employee liability is found in this Tomke case, right? Because that's the analysis that the trial court in this case didn't do.
But Stringer also says that, also cites Ramczyk for the proposition that an activity not explicitly within an employee's defined duties can nevertheless be related to the employee's duties if the work is in furtherance of the employee's business, and also cites Lange distinguishing between performance of authorized acts in a prohibited manner and the performance of a prohibited act. Those two citations together, I think, are problematic for your position, because here we have a situation where clearly the employer has authorized the employees to use the vehicle to get to and from work. So if we can read Lange in the inverse, and we can also presume that the district court is determining here that this work is in furtherance of the employee's business, noting that it's your burden here to prove this claim, how do we get around that, the adoption of those standards?
And Justice Eade, I disagree with your conclusion about clearly the employer authorized this. I don't find any of that evidence replete in any of the records that I have reviewed. In fact, Mr. Lamke's testimony, the only thing he says is that the employer was aware that he was carpooling. But
no, you said in your brief, the deposition testimony, it's an option I gave for their convenience.
Right. But
I mean, that's authorization. That's authorization. I'm giving you the option to use this truck to get to and from work.
Right. But that's Mr. Lamke's. That's the co-employee. That's not the employer. And there is a distinction to be had there about what the employer had is the job duties of Mr. Lamke. Mr. Lamke undertook these things on his own. It was something he offered as a convenience. And he literally testified about that convenience for his crew, essentially, so they could have a gas benefit. They didn't have to pay for gas driving to the job site. The employer actually did not compensate Mr. Tomke. If he drove to the job site, they didn't compensate him for his time commuting. They didn't compensate him for his gas commuting. None of that. And I think that's a pretty critical distinction here to be made, is that that is not something Mr. Lamke undertook with the explicit or implied authorization of the employer. They may not
knew he was using the vehicle to transport people to the job site, correct?
I believe that is the testimony that was occurred by Mr. Lamke. I don't believe Mr. Tomke concurred in that understanding. And I don't remember that specific point from Mr. Tomke's deposition testimony.
Dispute it, or did he just not concur in it?
I would say I would take the more conservative estimate. He did not concur in it. Because Mr.
Ferguson, can we get back to my original question? And that is, what is the legal authority that the action of the co-employee tortfeasor must be part of the job requirements that they are mandated to undertake? And they can't just be optional actions that would occur normally in the course and scope of employment or discretionary functions?
Well, I think that's just an analysis. I don't have a case law to simply cite that. That's a fact issue. That's something that would have to be illuminated because...
Would this be a new point of law that you're asking us to adopt?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, because in our brief, we talked about these four categories. And if the co-employee liability is to mean anything, right, because the statute says they have to be working at the same time, that first category we identified, there would have to be an exception somewhere. And that's the distinction we make.
And then why would we be the body that should adopt that exception? Why shouldn't this be something that the legislature should undertake as part of its analysis of the workers' compensation statute and the statutory exception to liability here?
Oh, I love that question. You know why I love that question? Because the Supreme Court did it multiple times under the same exception. And so let's be clear. We're talking about an act, an exemption, and then an exception, right? And the Supreme Court has walked through that door on each one of its cases to expand that. And if they didn't cover all the grounds, then this court would be free, I would submit to you, to carve out that area in as consistent with the court's determination of the heightened standard in Stringer. The black robes, and that's great. I mean, you guys can do that.
Can I pivot for 1 second? You made this point in your opening brief and in your reply brief. You cite Olson, the non-precedential decision, Chief Justice Hudson's decision when she was here at the Court of Appeals. And you there's a noticeable ellipsis in the middle of it. And you characterize, as I understand it, the importance of Olson is that the Court of Appeals, it seems like you're saying, rejected the idea that if the co-employee would qualify for workers' compensation benefits, had he or she been injured, then the co-employee would be entitled to co-employee immunity, and that the Court of Appeals then rejected or find no support for that interpretation in Stringer. What I want to ask you about is in Stringer, the Supreme Court specifically cites a case out of Kentucky called Jackson v. Hutchinson. That's from the Court of Appeals of Kentucky. I believe that's at 760 of Stringer that they say that their view is consistent with that. It's at page 760 of Stringer, is consistent with other courts. And at the end of Jackson v. Hutchinson, the Kentucky Supreme Court said a test of fellow employee immunity is whether each of the employees involved would have been entitled to workman's compensation benefits for any disabling injuries suffered in the accident. We think such a test is a good one and leads to a consistent application of the fellow employee immunity rule. Do you lose if we conclude that both parties here would have been entitled to workers' compensation benefits?
I actually do believe that that would be the necessary outcome if that's the test. And I would submit to you that.
So what do we do about that then? Stringer seems to be approvingly citing Jackson, and Jackson says that's the rule.
Yeah, but Jackson's in Kentucky. We're in Minnesota. And unfortunately, I had the outcome in the D'Angelo Profit versus HRT Holding case in which the Supreme Court said we're not bound to follow other courts. And particularly in that case, they decided not to adopt the Texas rule in Minnesota.
Right, but they did decide to cite approvingly to Jackson and Stringer. So I don't know how do we harmonize that?
Well, that's an interesting piece of jurisprudence, because part of my thing is I think Stringer is wrongly decided. And if that's the crux of this issue, I'm going to say it and say it loud and proud, because I think they expanded the distinction to a point which almost renders it. In fact, I'll tell you, if we follow their precedent to its logical conclusion, as the trial court did in this case, then 176.061 sub 5E is, for all intents and purposes, meaningless. I struggle to find a situation when two co-employees who are entitled to work comp benefits actually give rise to this, unless they're operating outside the course and scope of their employment vis-a-vis an intoxication argument under 176.021 sub 1, where it talks about intoxication of an employee as a defense to whether they have liability, or a prohibited act defense such as that cited in Otto v. Christensen by opposing counsel. I don't know what else there is. And so I wish I could kind of go down my next thought, but unfortunately, I didn't get to finish. I greatly appreciate your time and energy, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Counsel? You're on mute. Okay.
I'm kind of old school here and prefer to stand when I address the court. So counsel for the appellant went back to 1913. I'm only going
Could you just state your name for the record again?
I'm sorry, sure. Steve Reyelts, R-E-Y-E-L-T-S. Representing Mr. Lamke, the defendant, along with Eric Berg, B-E-R-G, representing Mr. Lamke. So I'm going back to 1983 when this court was established. Peter Popovich traveled around the state to convince lawyers why it was a good idea to have the Court of Appeals, an intermediate court of appeals. He came to Duluth. He spoke to us at the Bar Association meeting in 1983 at the Pickwick, and he explained why the court was going to be good for those of us outside of the Twin Cities, because this was to be a Minnesota court where the court would be comprised of judges, eight of whom would be from congressional districts, and there would be a geographical distribution. Then he traveled to the range. Then he traveled all around the state. Bemidji, Moorhead, Alexandria, Mankato, Wilmer, Rochester, Winona, saying the same thing, that the Court of Appeals was going to be a state court for the entire state of Minnesota. He said the court would be hearing cases in three-judge panels, and the three-judge panels would travel to the locales where the case was decided. That was the idea back in 1983. And he said that the court would be out among the people rather than in, using his words, an ivory tower in St. Paul, but instead would be going to the places where the decisions had been made. So, for instance, a Virginia case, oral argument would be held in Virginia. So, of course, that's changed with technology and with the pandemic. Now that we're coming out of the pandemic, we hope that the court will get back to that idea of traveling out to be among the people outside of the state, outside of the Twin Cities. Why do I mention that? Because if the three of you on the panel had decided, or if the powers that be at the Court of Appeals had decided that this case should be heard today in Virginia, then you would have gotten up and started your trip at 6 o'clock in the morning from the courts building. And the three of you might have said, hey, let's get together and drive up to Virginia to appear for the oral argument. And you might have requisitioned a state-owned vehicle from the state fleet. And the three of you would get together, one of you would drive, and the three of you would get into that vehicle, get on 35E, and start heading north to Virginia. For the moment the three of you got in that vehicle, you would be within the course and scope of your employment. And that's the case here. Mr. Lamke, our client, drove from his home to Virginia to pick up a vehicle owned by his employer, Lake States Tree Service. From that moment on, when he got in that vehicle and was in driving in the company car to the job site, Mr. Lamke was in the course and scope of his employment.
Mr. Rails, I appreciate the comparison. I think that the salient distinction that Mr. Ferguson would argue is that the three of us would be required to get in a car to travel to Virginia or wherever we were holding the argument, and that Mr. Tomke was not required to carpool together, or he was not required to transport him. So let's have you address that one narrow argument that Mr. Ferguson is making, and that is because this was not part of the required job responsibilities, that liability should attach.
I think, Judge Frisch, you already made the distinction when we in your questions earlier, and that is, what's the difference between required and authorized? And the fact of the matter is that Mr. Lamke was authorized to drive in that company-owned vehicle, and he was authorized to pick up Mr. Tomke and drive to the location where they were working. So he was authorized to do so, and because of that, that's the reason that Mr. Tomke was entitled to workers' compensation benefits, which he sought. In response to our request for admissions, he admitted that he was in the course and scope of his employment. And because Mr. Lamke was authorized to do this, not required, but authorized, Mr. Lamke was also within the course and scope of his employment. As Judge Peterson indicated in his memorandum of law and the findings of fact, both occupants of that vehicle were within the course and scope of their employment when the incident occurred.
Mr. Rails, I think Mr. Ferguson was suggesting that there's nothing in the record to support a finding of fact that, in fact, they did have the authorization from the employer, that this was something that Mr. Lamke undertook on his own as an individual, as opposed to something that was authorized by this tree service. If you could address where in the record we can find support for that, that would be helpful.
I think it's the converse that's true, Judge, and that is it's the plaintiff's burden to show that that Mr. Lamke was not in the course and scope of his employment. There was no evidence offered that Mr. Lamke was not authorized to use that vehicle and was not authorized to pick up Mr. Tomke. So I don't believe there's any explicit evidence in the record, explicit, indicating that Mr. Lamke was authorized to use that vehicle, but he said that's what he did. That was the course of his practice. He picked up that vehicle. He picked up his co-employee. If it's the contention of the plaintiff appellant in this case that doing so was outside of the scope of his employment, then it's the burden of the plaintiff and appellant to offer testimony to the contrary, and no such testimony was offered. Does that answer your question, Judge?
Yes.
Okay.
So, Mr. Rounds, I have another question. This is an issue that was raised in Mr. Ferguson's brief, and he also closed his argument with this issue. And I've been spending quite a bit of time thinking about this in the last couple of weeks, and I am coming up empty, so I'm hoping that you can help me. The argument that Mr. Ferguson is making is that the Stringer decision essentially renders the statute a nullity, that there's no circumstance when workers' compensation benefits are paid where an exception would apply, because Stringer provides that if workers' compensation benefits are paid, then the actor is necessarily within the course and scope of employment. So can you describe to me a situation where benefits are actually paid, where the exception might apply? And it may not be this situation, but just any situation, because I'm struggling to find a place where the statute might be effective.
Okay. Let's go back to the three of you esteemed judges traveling up to Virginia for an in-person oral argument. And one of you drives, and you're driving up Interstate 35, and the driver decides to stop at the casino, Black Bear Casino. And the two passengers play video poker, but the driver decides to go and have three or four drinks at the bar. That is forbidden conduct, if we were talking about the Lange decision that was referred to. The other two have not done anything forbidden. They're still in the course and scope of their employment. They haven't conducted a detour that was forbidden. They would be entitled to workers' compensation benefits, but the driver, the tortfeasor, has gone outside of the scope of his employment, even though he or she is driving up to the place where they were going, has gone outside of the scope of their employment, and therefore is subject to the exclusion in this case. So,
I mean, isn't Swanson v. Time Savers, which Mr. Ferguson cites, an actual real world example of that exact type scenario? The person that offered to help operate or help fix the machine in that situation didn't have the authority to do that. And as a result, even though the person who was injured collected workers' compensation benefits, they were also able to collect in tort outside of that.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for the help, Judge, on that. So going back to the Cook decision that was referred to here, I think that shows that there can be gross misconduct. And by the way, we didn't get to the point in this case where Judge Peterson needed to make a finding as to whether there was gross misconduct or not, because of the finding that both of the parties involved were in the course and scope of his employment. But I wanted to point out the Cook decision, because that was the ambulance driver decision. The ambulance driver, Pearson, actually it was Pearson who died in the accident and not Cook. Cook was injured, Cook sued, and that court, subsequent to Stringer, said exactly as this court should: we can't overturn Stringer. Stringer says if the parties are in the course and scope of their employment.
But that's a little different though, right? Because in that situation, the ambulance driver's job is to drive the ambulance, right? So that goes to Mr. Ferguson's argument. You know, that case seems to me to be helpful to him, because that was the duty of the driver. And so that, you know, that's a much easier course and scope of employment argument there. Their job is tree service. You know, their job is not to drive the truck to the tree service site. So help me out on how that's well, helpful to your position.
That gets to the difference between requirement and authority. But the fact of the matter is, wherever they meet, they need to drive that truck to the site. They need that truck. The truck is part of what they use at the site. It's part of their job to get to the site. And once they're together in the truck driving to the job site, they're on the clock and they're in the course and scope of their employment. And again, back to the, just checking on my timer, back to the question of course and scope and being in the course and scope of their employment as they're driving. This is something that the plaintiff characterized as being in the course and scope of their employment himself, because he elected to seek workers' comp benefits. He accepted the benefits all because he was in the course and scope of his employment from the moment he got into that truck at the Walmart parking lot in Hibbing. So, judges, I think that's all I have, unless there are additional questions.
No, thank you. Can you pronounce your last name one more time? Is it Reyltz?
Reyltz.
Thank you, Mr. Reyltz.
You look at the EYE, it's like I, see? So, Reyltz.
Thank you, Mr. Reyltz. Mr. Ferguson?
Very good. So I'm going to move with some speed. Mr. Lamke's deposition, page 42, page 43, he was expressly asked the question. So would you say it was the rule rather than the exception that you would drive individuals that you were groundmen to the job site? It wasn't a rule. It was just an option I gave because I had the chase truck in Virginia. So I think we have the distinction. I think you've honed in on the issue, authorization versus rule. I think it's the record is problematic for the position that we have to provide factual information. They have the burden of actually coming forward with a fact that is not in dispute, establishing that Mr. Lamke was in fact directed as a part of his job to provide this transportation in the carpool. And that doesn't exist.
But what is the fact in the record that it was not part of his job responsibilities or job duties?
Well, at page 43 of his depo, we asked that question, right? And you said it wasn't a rule that Lake State's tree service imposed. Was it a part of your general administrative duties to drive people, or was it an option that you gave them for their convenience? His answer was, it was an option I gave for their convenience.
Well, being a job duty is different than doing something within the course and scope of your employment.
Well, that's right. But the terms that the tree service imposed, or that they provided Mr. Lamke, is the problem. This wasn't one of those job duties. It wasn't part of his employment. He did it for convenience. And I think that's the thing we're struggling with, is where do you draw that line? Because that's the Stringer issue, right? Except in Stringer,
I mean, for convenience, I might work from home from time to time, or for convenience, I might do something else as part in the course and scope of my employment. That doesn't necessarily mean that I wouldn't be entitled to workers' compensation benefits if I were injured in the course and scope of employment. See what I'm saying?
It is, but it becomes a formalism. That it gets, like, if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. And so it's like, that's the problem in the case law, from my perspective, is there isn't a meaningful analysis to distinguish those things. And in this instance, because we're dealing with summary judgment, they need to come forward with it. And I want to clarify something about how workers' compensation operates. So if you get injured in the job and an employer submits a claim to the insurance company, which in this case is Western National, as identified in the deposition transcript, they make a determination as to compensability of this claim. They file a document called a Notice of Primary Liability Determination. It's a one-page form. It has three boxes on it. They check it. Your claim's accepted. Checkbox two is what's called a medical-only claim. And the last one is, we deny primary liability, which is, are you in the course and scope of your employment? There is zero input on behalf of the employee in their legal determination. And Western National is the one who made that decision, not my client. Now, my client did agree to accept those benefits, so there's no dispute with that. But I just want to clarify that dynamic a little bit, because there seems to be a suggestion Mr. Tomke did this all on his own, and he just kind of said, I want the benefits, and they were paid. There's an issue here that I don't want to get into, but I get back to the bottom line issue, is that the record identifies that
accepted the benefits, though. It's right. Not like he repudiated the benefits.
Correct. And that's right. But if the question is, if you receive benefits, you can't have co-employee or co-extensive liability with the co-employee. Well, then.
And that really concerns me about, you know, I get when you're saying that there really is no meaningful exception to the co-employee immunity statute. I don't understand how we reconcile that to the question I asked Mr. Reyltz. Why doesn't Swanson repudiate your position there? There was workers' compensation benefits paid and a tort judgment paid there and was upheld on appeal. Why shouldn't that address your concern?
Because here's the interesting thing. In that case, they appeared to make an analysis as to whether the co-employee was operating outside the scope of his employment. And I actually think that decision is very troublesome for everybody, because Anytime a co-employee operates outside the scope of the employment, but in an effort to assist a co-employee in furtherance of their job duties, they're exposed to liability. But yet in this case, a person who undertakes something that wasn't provided by the employer to do, does it, and then falls asleep causing serious injury, and he's barred under Stringer. Like, those two outcomes seem wildly in conflict with one another, from my perspective, because we're not even talking about driving. We're talking about, in the Swanson case, they're both at a job site. They're not commuting. There's not a dispute about whether one's in the course of while commuting independently and not paid, which is part of the in the course of. And on the other hand, they're literally all there on the clock doing work, and they get benefits. I think the case law is not consistent in that analysis. It wasn't here, and we would ask for reversal. Thank you much.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Thank you, Mr. Reilts. The matter is submitted. We will issue a decision in due course. Mr. Reilts, I do appreciate your concern about appearing in Greater Minnesota more often. We all here are very concerned about that and like to come out for travel calendars when we have a critical mass. So thank you for raising it to our attention.
I have one comment. That was the fastest 5 minutes I've ever had. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.